It's time for conversations about our food and how it's grown on Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.
Urban agriculture. Those are two words that don't seem like they should be fitting together, but they do. Increasingly, people are talking about urban agriculture. But what do we mean when we say urban agriculture? Well, my guest today knows all about it. He's been doing it for years all over the world. My guest from Atlanta is Rashid Nuri. And I really am happy to welcome Rashid to Farm to Table Talk. Rashid, when did you start using the term urban agriculture?
Back in the early 70s.
Well, that really was the early days. I bet people were scratching their head when they heard you say urban agriculture then.
That's the joke. People think I'm crazy now. You can imagine what they thought back then.
So what was your situation in the early 70s?
Finished school and went out to California to find some work. Actually, the best schooling I had was the several months that I traveled all over California visiting. California is the richest agricultural producing region in the history of the world. And I was up and down the Central Valley and all around trying to see about what kind of work I could do and talking with and to so many of the agriculturists, cotton and almond growers and the grape growers, the vegetable growers, artichokes out in Watsonville, just learning more and more from a practical point of view how commercial agriculture works. So but the first work I actually did was in San Diego. They wouldn't even give me a full title of extension agent. I was an assistant extension agent, but I worked with children in schools. We built community gardens. When I started, there was only one community garden in San Diego County when I left. But when I came back sometime later, they had 60. So we helped get that started. We built an urban farm in the middle of the city. You know, as the years have gone on, I've come to understand urban agriculture in a much broader sense than just growing food in a garden. Urban agriculture, as opposed to urban farming, urban agriculture covers a much, you have to be concerned about food, water, housing, all of that plays into it. And I have discovered that urban agriculture cannot solve, but it certainly can be part of the solution to any problems that you have in an urban area. I've ended up my work here, that phase of my work, twice now I've built the largest urban farm in the metropolitan area. And what we find is that wherever we build a farm, property values go up, crime goes down, we've created a space for that's safe for people, women and children. We use no chemicals at all, and we become a center of activity. The Truly Living Well Center for Natural Urban Agriculture is an organization.
When did you establish the Truly Living Well Center?
It was conceived in 2005 and broke ground in 2006.
So you broke ground. So you actually have a facility there?
Oh, yes, yeah, the largest in the city. 7 acres with hoop house, greenhouse, aquaponics, composting, raised beds, in-ground beds, they just planted some new trees, 140 fruit trees, beehives. It's pretty organic. It's pretty complete.
This is in Atlanta?
Well, this farm, the current farm, is in the West End. Do you know where the Atlanta University centers are, the Morehouse, Spelman?
No, I don't. I don't know that.
All right. But it's very, very much in the city. We had one in the old 4th Ward, which we moved from, and from that site on the freeway, we were in the shadow of the downtown skyscrapers. So this is part of what our work has done, is exposing a greater community to what urban agriculture can look like and the contributions it can make to the society.
Describe the neighborhood for us.
The middle of the, when I say central city, oftentimes that means just black people. But in this case, that's not true. There's these neighborhoods are gentrifying. The first one, the large farm we did, which was 6+ acres, was right near the university, Georgia State University, Grady Hospital, and across the street from Ebenezer Baptist Church, which was Martin Luther King Jr.'s home church. So we were right there. Now we've moved on the other side of the freeway to the west side of town. That was the east side. Now we're on the west side, and we have Morehouse, Spelman, Clark, which is the center of the black colleges in the metropolitan area, and we're three blocks west of the stadium in a neighborhood that is becoming highly integrated. These are middle and upper middle class people that reside in both those neighborhoods that I just described.
How's that going, being in the midst of gentrification?
Yeah, that's the problem. And that, you know, gentrification is a very polite term for what is indeed whitetrification. Both of these neighborhoods were predominantly black at one time. Both of the sites that we grew on, the larger sites that we had, used to be housing projects. So the concern that I have is that all these people who used to live on the public housing, where have they gone? How have they been provided for? And that is, you know, the deconstruction of these sites, right in the middle of the depression that we had some years ago, people got moved out of the city into houses that they couldn't afford, yet now we still have all these folk who are homeless. It's distressing. Yes, sir. But the other side of it is every neighborhood that each of the neighborhoods that we've been in, and the reason I make that distinction, we have a lot of smaller plots around the city that we have grown on, but these two large ones, they're the biggest farms in the area. But each of those areas, the crime has gone down, sex trade has diminished, drug trade is gone, property values go up. And through my work, we've been able to increase employment. We had as many as 35 people on the payroll. The education programs that we have, training people in agriculture, horticultural literacy, which is knowing who grows your food, the quality of your food, where your food comes from, financial literacy, as well as actually how to grow food. We've had as many as 4 farmers markets a week where we sold our food. So, you know, the subtitle for my work is we grow food, we grow people, we grow communities. And Truly Living Well has done that here in Atlanta.
Who decides what's going to happen on this land?
The organization that I founded. You know, I've been involved in agriculture over 50 years, taking me around the world. I've worked in 36 countries around the world, lived overseas about 10 years, and have seen how local food economies are developed around the world. It used to be that humankind lived within walking distance of where their food was produced. In this country, that doesn't exist anymore. Our food travels 1,500 miles on average to get to us, and people are just completely disconnected from the sources of their food. So through my work, I think we have created a local food economy. The paradigm has shifted. I think that the big ag system that we employ in this country is broken. Doesn't work. People are getting sick. The food that we consume, the food that's being produced, is making people sick. And you can trace that to a couple of seminal events that have happened in this country. When Henry Wallace hired Norman Boulard to start what became the Green Revolution, you can see where the disease went up. And in 1996, when GMOs were introduced into the food chain, the disease charts have shot straight up. So those are the kinds of concerns that I have around my work. The fact is that we live in the richest country in the entire history of the world, yet we have so many people who are sick. Our health care is very poor. You have so many homeless people. The education system is far from being the best in the world. And I think that around that, the urban agriculture is able to contribute to the solution to some of these problems. And we're very proud of that.
Still, there are a lot of foods that you could not produce in Atlanta.
Well, here's how I address that, Roger. In the metro, Atlanta is the greenest city in this country by virtue of trees and open space, you know, metro Atlanta. And there is enough land to grow all the fruits and vegetables that we need to feed the people. What you can't grow are grains and meat. And you told me that you've been very much in the meat business. You can't do that in a city. That has to be done in a rural area. But all the rest of the stuff we can grow. Here in Atlanta, you can grow 12 months a year. And the hoop houses that are being propagated around help to extend the seasons on both ends. You can start earlier and you can stay out in the fields later because you can have production coming out later because of the hoop houses.
Well, that's interesting. There are some things that you can't grow, such as almonds, but you could grow pecans. And if you have hoop houses, you could grow a lot of things.
That's correct. Now, pecan trees, you will find some pecan trees in the city. We had a couple on our farm. You know, pecans produce every other year. That's how they trick the animals. One tree, you know, trees next to each other, they're swapped which year they actually produce. But they are very huge. No, that's much more appropriate in either a rural or a peri-urban area, more so than in the inner city. But on our farm, we have this 140 fruit trees. We've got peaches, pears, plums, pomegranate vines. We have berry vines, persimmons, pawpaw, figs. I can go through the list. You know, all this stuff is growing right there. And that was part of the emphasis of my work and why I created the Center for Natural Urban Agriculture, is so that people can see these crops being produced and be able to taste them.
I'm trying to picture this. So you start with a space, in the middle of Atlanta, and decide on what you can grow there?
Yeah, I ask people, just grow where you are, backyard, front yard, kitchen windows, balconies, patios. You can grow anywhere. It doesn't always have to be in the ground. A couple of these projects that we've done, we use raised beds. So rather than going down, you want to go up. It's a lot easier. You have better control over your soil and weed control. And it's for newcomers, people who are just getting involved with it, makes it a lot easier for them to use raised beds.
I've heard of some cities that actually put raised beds on top of vacated basketball courts and roads that had been closed, and they could just put a raised bed there and start growing on top of that.
That's correct. You can make the right height. You can grow just about anything you want. There are certain crops that I don't grow because they take up too sweet corns. Corn takes up too much space. And for too long for the yield that you get. And I don't grow those, but squashes, melons, all the rest of it, we can grow that in their season appropriately.
Say we identify a city where there's some space available. What's the first step you need to take?
It's an excellent question. The answer is no, I don't. If you are doing a community garden, a garden where people are going to come and grow their own food in that space, and there are several hundred of those here in Atlanta, then you would have a community meet. For doing an urban farm, you just start doing the work, and the people will come. So you build it, they come.
So you're saying that if an individual has space available, they can just start farming and whatever that space is?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know anybody who plants some vegetables in their yard, they can eat it all. I don't care how much space. One tomato plant is going to grow more tomatoes than you can consume. So it's an opportunity to swap with your neighbors, to go to a local farmer's market, community market. When I began this work in Atlanta, you had trouble finding any farmer's market. Now there are several of them any day of the week. Many of them go through the winter, offering fresh produce to the community. So urban agriculture, urban farms, urban gardening, community gardening is very much a way to build community, to bring people together. And that which leads to one of the issues, the demand for natural food, the kinds of quality of food that we produce, the demand is much higher than the supply. That's why at Truly Live Well, a major part of our work has been training people. Teaching them how to grow food and how to process it. We are a training and education center. We've had as many as seven sessions of summer camp for the children. classes for women and children where they learn not only gardening but financial literacy. So the range, we have an elementary school directly across the street from the farm that was the first STEM-certified school in Atlanta public school system, and the principal will tell you that the reason that they were able to get the STEM is because the children could come across the street for some of their learning experience, and the teachers could come. Teachers, what do they have that? They have to do their take continuing education classes, and are able to do that on the farm. I was just at a meeting this morning doing something similar to this, an interview is how they organize it. It's a nice little crowd, and one of the women in the crowd had graduated from our initial training program back in the last decade. And she tells, she acknowledged that she knew nothing about about agriculture until she took our classes. And now she's developed a program where she will have pop-up markets 3 or 4 times a week to sell produce. And she has 160 households now growing food. And so that is how this, what was a movement, has spread to become an economy that people could participate in. There are farmers markets all over the town, like I said, every day of the week. So the concern that I have, Roger, with the demand greater than supply, where are we going to get the farmers? And if the farmers graduate from our class, they have an interest and get started, how are they going to have the support to make their enterprise successful? A question that I am often asked is our work, is our organization self-sufficient and self-sustaining? And my response is, no, it's not. Why should it be? Big Ag is not self-sufficient. It is completely supported by the taxpayers of this country. So what I would, for example, unless you lived in California, you don't realize there is no water in California. It's all imported. So despite the fact that California is the richest agricultural producing region in the history of the world, they couldn't be done without the taxpayer support. We pay for the money, and that's the history of California is built around that water. So what that leads me to is that what's needed in the urban area is a new Homestead Act. The Homestead Act, Abraham Lincoln in 1862 did several things. He set up the People's Department, the Department of Agriculture. He passed the Homestead Act, which gave free land and support to people to come and farm in the U.S., primarily in the Midwest and the upper Midwest. You see all those folks of Scandinavian origin in Iowa and Minnesota and Nebraska, they were all supported to come in. They established the Morrill Act of 1862. It was set up the land grant colleges. Agriculture does that. The agricultural producers don't do any R&D. They don't have to make any investment. It's because the land grant colleges provide that information. When I started in this business, it took 12 weeks or more to grow a broiler. Now you get them, they turn them out in 6 weeks. Who did the research to be able to make the birds produce at that level and the varieties done at the universities, which was supported? And then finally, you had the Railroad Act, which was produced, which came out in 1862. I've traveled throughout this country, and I have never seen a steel foundry in Iowa or Nebraska or the Dakotas. All that steel and the equipment had to come from the east where they were manufactured, and that's why they passed also in 1862 the Railroad Act in order to bring all that equipment out there. All of that has helped to create the infrastructure which supports the agriculture, big ag in this country. And what I intend to work on in the next few years is the policy change so that we can have a Homestead Act to support urban and small farms in this country, because I believe that's the future. 82% of Americans live in urban areas. The world is anticipated to be 70% urban by the year 2050. Where is that food going to come from? How are we going to feed those people? I don't think that the paradigm of shipping food all the way across the country and around the world is going to continue. Yes, if you want to have bananas, they're going to have to be imported. Which is one of the arguments people give about pineapples and bananas. They will still continue to be imported if that's what people want to eat. But we need to have, I would like to see a public support for urban agriculture, small farms and urban agriculture, because I am convinced that's going to be the future of production. It's how it's done around the world, and I think that's going to be the future of American agriculture, is to get back to the past where it was small farms and that produced the food.
These are good points, although I would take exception to the point about subsidies, because there are a half dozen main subsidies of 300 some commodities, but there are hundreds and hundreds of crops that are grown across the country that don't have any subsidy at all.
Tomatoes.
No, that's not, Roger, that's not true. Okay, out in California where they have those 350 varieties, that water is subsidized. Well, taxpayers here in Georgia pay for it.
You're right. The government has had to invest in water systems to take care of the population nearing 40 million people and all the farms in California. But the farmers also have to pay for the water. And there are many commodities where that is the single biggest category of their operating expense.
Doesn't work. If you study the history of California, its development has been based around the water. I mean, they've made a couple of movies about it. Chinatown talked about the water going into Los Angeles. Los Angeles is the largest irrigated valley in the world. All that water comes from other places. The San Joaquin Valley. Okay, that water, there's no water out there. You can dig and try and put a well in, but it's not going to be easy. That's why you have those two major canals that go down the state, which channels that water in there for the farmers, and all of that was paid by the taxpayers. So that is one of the misnomers that people have is to say that, you know, that all that farming does not have support when it's fundamentally supported. It's supported by all the research that's done at the university and the money that went in to build that infrastructure. So it's that infrastructure construction that I think a new Homestead Act can help to build a create the alternative food supply that I think we need.
Most of the land-grant universities in the country are beginning to work on sustainability programs, and I think quite a few of them are starting to pay attention to small farms and some certainly urban farming.
The academy is getting involved. The universities are getting involved. But one of the problems that I see is the unfortunate connection and continued support between the petrochemical industry, the universities, and the agriculture. Those chemicals are killing us. You know, we need to get them out of the field. I have a problem with the genetic modification of all of our food, whether it's the plants and vegetables or the GMOs that go into the animals. The fact that you have animals being grown up on feedlots where they have to have all the antibiotics because they're laying around in their own filth on concrete, when those ruminants started off eating grass, and that's how they are produced. You got a man down here in Georgia who has a very large operation that has, he's got beef cows, chickens, turkeys, ducks, goats, all his meat, and he has his own abattoir right there on the farm, largest abattoir privately owned east of Mississippi. So there's a different way of approaching this work.
This homestead idea is very interesting. So how are you going to get started? Do you get funding going from the federal level and from the state level?
You think global, but you act local. There's a town here in Georgia, Sparta. Sparta is in Hancock County. It is the poorest and the blackest county in the state of Georgia. Georgia got a lot of counties. And there's a man named Robert Curry who went down to Sparta and started an enterprise. He has 11 hoop houses, greenhouses, chicken houses, compost operation, and he has 3 incubators for mushrooms. He's created this infrastructure. He has 3 wells on his property. Right there in the city of Sparta, which is the county seat, and Now he's put the, we got one of the best farm, young farmers here in Atlanta. We helped make a deal so that Chris is going to go down and run that. Robert has created the infrastructure to support a young farmer to go in there and earn a decent living. Now, you're not with urban agriculture and small farms, you're not going to be, it's highly unlikely that you're going to build a five garage house with five garages. You're not going to make that kind of money. But if you have an interest in the field of work, you can make a decent living on a small piece of land, on a small farm, and that's what I would like to see happen. You know, the concept, you got, what, 1% of the people in this country are farmers, and they're all old. They're like me. And you, we've been out here a while, and was trying to get an infusion of young people to support this, to grow the food. And you know, as I've traveled the world, as I've said, I've worked in 36 countries around the world. I've experienced local food economies on a fundamental level. A lot of these places where they think the women are oppressed, the truth of the matter is the women run those economies. They're the ones that control the money, the economics, the food. The food system, and without that, there is no culture without agriculture, none. People have to eat, and we need to get closer to our food, the horticultural literacy, knowing who grows your food, the quality of your food, and where your food comes from. And that's only going to come from doing a reinvention to be able to look at our food systems from a different perspective, at different from this commercial ad, which is driven by money. It's driven by the petrochemical industry. I mean, just think about, you know, they had a major increase in the production of corn in the Midwest and other crops right after the Second World War. The munitions manufacturers made a lot of money during the war with their guns and bullets, okay? And ammonium nitrate is a major is the major fertilizer this is used, and that's the, it is gunpowder. That's what was done. So that money, that petrochemical-derived product is put out of the field, so now you get a whole lot of corn coming out of there, surpluses, which have to be sold and then distributed around the world, and we think that's progress when, in fact, that food is killing us. Let's give you one example. I don't know how it is in your neighborhood, but down here in Atlanta, a whole lot of people are now eating. They have to, food has to be gluten-free. Every menu you see in a restaurant talks about the gluten-free food because people have allergies to bread. Now, man has been eating bread for tens of thousands of years. Why is it that today, after in the last 10 or 15 years, people have to have gluten-free bread? And they don't even, most folks don't even know what gluten is. That's the real joke. But they're allergic to the food that they're eating. And it's because it is GMO, and it's hybrids and GMO, and it's killing us. We're being dying from the very food that we are putting in our body, which is supposed to be the source of all life, source of our health, and it's not. So those are conundrums that we have to fix.
How do you see urban homesteading getting started? Will there need to be subsidies?
Roger, I suggest to you that this is the future. You're going to see this more and more as time goes on, and the answer is yes. This new paradigm or this reoccurring paradigm needs the same level of subsidy that Big Ag had for almost 200 years.
All over, there are small farms getting started, and they're finding some ways to support themselves, going into CSAs and farmers markets and other combinations to be able to get on their feet. Is this what's going to happen with urban agriculture, that it will be supplementing perhaps another income?
Well, that's the same thing that happens with the small farm. Most of these small farmers, their sole income isn't coming from the farm. It's supplemented. And that used to be a way of life, but it's been changed. And notice that I say very distinctly small farms and urban agriculture. I lump those together as contrasted with Big Ag over those huge acreage, small margins, and plentiful chemicals, killing the land. think, look at, you know, I tell folks, the first on a farm, the first livestock you want to have are earthworms. Yeah, and when I go to visit a farm, I'm like, that question, you see many earthworms out there? And immediately, if they say no, then that tells me what the practices are that they are employing. The quality of your soil, the best indicator of the quality of your soil is the number of earthworms that you're going to find.
Sure.
And I guarantee you, you go to most farms, big farms in this country, that soil is absolutely dead. There's no micro, no roly-polies, millipedes, centipedes, funguses, mycorrhiza in that soil. The soil is dead because what the universities have done, and out there right down the road from where you live, at Davis is considered the finest ag school in the country, they teach in those farmers to use the dirt as a receptacle for the roots of those plants, and they're going to add all the chemicals that you need, that they think it needs. You do a soil test with the universities, these land-grant colleges test your soil, and it comes back, it tells you how much chemicals to put on your land to grow whatever the crop is. They don't tell you to compost. They don't tell you to minimize the tillage of that soil. These are not the techniques that are being taught, but these are the ones that are life-preserving. And what people have demonstrated throughout history around the world are the techniques that are proper. All this way that we farm now is new.
Well, there are sustainability programs going on all over the country right now, and there are regenerative agriculture programs of all sizes and shapes across the country. And, you know, on the programs that you're looking at in urban agriculture, is your bottom line message is that everybody should take a look in their city at where they are and the possibilities that they could start their own farm within the city or be able to promote gardens in the city?
Yes, sir. And all over the country. In the suburb, in the inner cities, urban areas, suburban areas, peri-urban areas, all just as you move out from the center. Because this is where the people are. 82% of Americans live in metropolitan areas.
Sure. There's a lot for us to talk about. If people want to get more information on some of the things that you're bringing up today, where could you point them? Online, or also you've written a book?
Well, thank you for mentioning my book. I've written a book called Growing Out Loud, a journey of a food revolutionary, is what people have called me. You can call me. My number is 404-520-8331, 404-520-8331. I have a website, The Nuri Group. My name is Nuri, and it's in Nancy, U-R-I, thenurigroup.com. If you look at trulylivingwell.com, the other organization that I founded but no longer am the CEO of, and I have a blog, and I love to share this information, love opportunities to share it. I'm really grateful and appreciative that you've had me on today, and I hope that I've been able to give your readers some additional things to think about. And what I suggest, you know, when you go to buy clothes, you don't buy the first thing that's in the store. You try it on. You try on clothes and see what fits. So I would tell folks, if you don't challenge what I'm saying, you go look it up. Do your own research and see if you can find a way to, if you agree with what I'm doing, that's great. If you don't, that's fine too. But just study the subject. Go do the work and get this information. There's a book. You really want to get deep into the subject. It's a book by a man named F. William Engdahl. It's called Seeds of Destruction. Seeds of Destruction. And it's the most, it's just an amazing book. It's about the hidden agenda of genetic manipulation in our food system. There's just so much pertinent information in that book that can be found. So the information is out there. You just got to search for it. And if you want to get in touch with me, my email address is Rashid at the Nuri Group, thenurigroup.com, thenurigroup.com.
Sheed, I have to thank you for giving all these different ways that our listeners can get in touch with you directly. Anymore, people are reluctant to give out phone numbers, let alone email, and on all the other ways that they can reach you. So I'm sure somebody's going to take you up on that invitation. And there's so much more we could talk about. I keep getting encouraged because there's so many frontiers in agriculture, and I think there's a lot of really exciting things happening, both at small farms and also large-scale farms. There's people doing a good job of all sizes and shapes across the country. So we need to come back again and continue this conversation, and thanks for being on Farm to Table Talk.
All right, sir. You have a good day. Peace be unto you.
Thanks for listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.